This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, if you're a football fan, or maybe even if you aren't, the departure of Lionel Messi from Barcelona this summer was a very big story indeed. For football people, the biggest story in a very long time. He's gone to PSG, but the very fact that somebody so strongly linked to this great club would be leaving, having been there since he was a child, really, was a big shock. The reason the club gave was that they couldn't afford to pay his wages and stay within the constraints of the Spanish league's wage laws. However, for those who were disappointed not to see him in a Barcelona shirt anymore, and I think many people will never forget, particularly young people, the Barcelona team from 2006 to maybe 2016, the memories they left, the greatness of their team and so many of their wonderful players is an enduring memory for people that will be talked about as long as football is played. And there's a magnificent new book about Barca that's just been published. The author is Simon Cooper. Simon is a Dutch man and he knows an awful lot about football. He writes for the Financial Times on a variety of topics, sometimes on sport. And it's a pleasure to welcome him to The Stand. Simon, this is a magnificent book and congratulations. The fact that you were from the Netherlands was of some great assistance, I imagine, in outlining the history of this club.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm not Dutch, but when I was 6 or 7, my dad got a job in the Netherlands. So we moved there and that's where I fell for football, began playing on a street, joined a club, became a fan. And so I grew up with Dutch football. And the father of Dutch football, as you know, is Johan Cruyff, who wasn't just the best player of the 70s, but also the sort of most interesting thinker on football, I think, that we've had in the last 50 or 60 years. And so I grew up as a teenager later. He came back to Holland in 1981 when I was a teenager, not him. And I would read interviews with him, and reading Cruyff, listening to Cruyff talk about football was just such an education. And in a way, he educated the whole Dutch nation and later the whole Catalan nation about football. And of course, Cruyff was intrinsically linked to Barca. He played there, he coached there, he created the Masia there. Well, he reformed the Masia according to his views, the youth academy. And so I really start the history of Barcelona in the book in 1973, which is when Cruyff arrived from, you know, this very advanced country, the Netherlands, which is then playing the best football in the world, the best club in the world, Ajax. He comes to this backward, poor dictatorship to join the second club of the country, Barcelona, which had never been very successful. And then he transforms it. So that's really where I try to start the story.
Yes, and one of the early revelations, if you like, was that Barcelona had not always been, for example, like Manchester United, a big club. It had been a small club, a local club, really. And the title of your third chapter is FC Barcelona from an original idea by Johan Cruyff. Cruyff, as you say, had already had great success with Ajax. They won the then European Cup. Were they coached by Rinus Michels?
Yes, in the early 70s. And he and Cruyff really worked together, mutual irritation and inspiration, a bit like Lennon and McCartney in devising this new way of football.
And the core principle, well, you correct me if I'm wrong, But the core principles appear to be that possession of the ball hurts your opponents. They can't do anything without the ball. And also that static positions are damaging and that you can develop a way of playing. It became known as total football in the early years when Ajax emerged, again, not having been a big club.
Yeah, Ajax, you know, when Cruyff, he sort of grew up at the club. His father was a grocer opposite the stadium. From the age of four, Cruyff would be hanging around the stadium, you know, raising the flag on match days, sitting in the changing room with the first team. So he really grew up at Ajax. And when he's 17, he gets into the first team. Tiny kid, very thin, 1964. And at that point, they're one of the three or four big clubs in Amsterdam. And they're a semi-professional club. I mean, they're really, they're nothing. And then what happens is in 1965, this sort of lunatic figure, Rinus Michels, arrives as the new coach. And he's also a gym teacher for disabled children. He's part-time Ajax coach. And he has this idea, we're going to become the best club in the world, which is insane. You know, Dutch football never amounted to anything.
Of course.
And he meets Cruyff, and Cruyff and he sort of slowly develop what came to be called total football, as you say, although they never called it that. They didn't really have a name for it. And the fascinating thing to me writing about it was that the football they develop, you know, as you say, possession, playing in the other team's half, rapid interchange of possessions, and then pressing. When we lose the ball, we win it back immediately. We press as a group. And that was revolutionary. And it was a time when Italian Catenaccio defensive football was dominant. So they invent this style of football, which now today, 50 years on, has become sort of the orthodoxy of the best clubs. Yes, so when you watch Bayern Munich, Manchester City, Liverpool, when you watch Italy at the Euro, you see Cruyffian football, an updated version, but Cruyff would have recognized it instantly.
Yes, and it was 1973 when he arrived in Barcelona. He didn't seem to be able to form enduring relationships. Would that be because intellectually he was so far ahead of other players in particular?
Yeah, I mean, he did have a very stable family life. So in that sense, he had enduring relationships inside his family.
Yes.
But he fought with everybody else. So he loved conflict. He loved arguing. He loved talking. And he disagreed with everyone. And he would walk into every situation and say, you're doing it all wrong. You've got to do it like I say. And of course, this engenders constant conflict. And he was unable to keep his mouth shut. So he was impossible. He was a really difficult man to deal with. I mean, he could be very friendly and charming, but he turned everything into conflict. And that's also why he left Ajax. And at Barcelona, he arrives at this club where nobody really understands modern football. They have this huge stadium, 100,000 seats, but they play very backward football. And he and Michels have a go at, you know, modernizing it. Doesn't work terrifically well. It's only when he comes back as coach in 1988 where he has this dictatorial control that suited him very well, that he's able to turn Barcelona into a fully Cruyffian club.
And he was also a very heavy smoker, which in fact, when I reflect on his career, he was a great player, undoubtedly. But smoking was something that it indicates, smoking at the rate he did, that he lived on his nerves. And in the end, of course, he did die tragically from lung cancer. But a restless man. In Barcelona, when he arrived, how long did it take him, A, to become disenchanted with what he found, and B, to persuade people? What was that progression like, and how long did it take, Simon?
Well, he arrives in 73, and the first season is the best, the most successful. 73-74, he and Michels take Barcelona to the league title, the first they've won in 14 years. And they beat Madrid, they beat Real Madrid 5-0 in Madrid. It's a match that everyone still remembers. And this is also as Franquismo, the dictatorship, is crumbling. The dictator, Franco, is in his late 70s, he's dying. And so Catalonia, the region around Barcelona, is sort of sensing the chance of liberty, being allowed to speak its own language, having more freedom. So it's a very exciting time for them. And so this season will always be remembered. But then they sort of fall into decline. And Cruyff, declines very early because, as you say, he smoked all the time. And so by his late 20s, sort of in the mid-70s, he's not the player he was. He's thinking of retirement. And in 1978, his last season at Barcelona, he pulls the plug. He says, okay, that's it. I'm 31. My career is over. And then it turns out he thought he was really a brilliant businessman. So he invested with weird associates into all these completely hopeless ventures. So he retires and goes bankrupt at about the same time. And then he has to start playing again. And so the first World Barcelona isn't very successful. He goes to the United States. He discovers the joy of teaching, of explaining football to people, which was his real vocation. He could do it brilliantly. Yes. And then, you know, he returns to Holland. And then in 88, he becomes coach of Barcelona. And I'd say that his period as coach, 88 to 96, is actually much more transformative, where he gets every team from the under eights to the first team playing his style of football, where also he goes into the youth academy, and he was fascinated by youth football and how to coach kids. And he says, you're doing it all wrong. What you should do is, football is all about the pass. It's all about understanding how space works and who's a pass to when. And that's what we're going to teach. And it doesn't matter whether a kid is 5 foot tall or 6 foot. We'll take anyone of any size who can pass. And actually, you're too modest to mention it, but in the book, I quote you about the communion between people who are passing to each other and yes. who learn to understand and anticipate each other's moves. And that's sort of what the Barcelona Youth Academy teaches kids for
yes, their childhood. Yeah, and it's sensuous almost.
It's love.
It is love, and it's instinctive. And at that time, as you said earlier, the Italian ideas, which were much more regimented, and indeed in England, it was a barren time for football too, because instinct and individuality were on the way out, whereas he was inoculating Barca with these ideas.
Yeah, and so actually focusing on the past, which now seems much more normal to us, it's the way all the top teams have learned to think, partly because they all copied Barcelona.
Yes. But
yeah, at the time it was quite revolutionary. And, you know, none of the English players who grew up in the late 80s or early 90s were learning this kind of football. And the ones who did have that instinctive sense of the past of that era, like Gascoigne or Hoddle, were, you know, never fully trusted.
Yes.
And were always sort of marginal figures, whereas people like Brian Robson and much more English figures, or Terry Butcher, were first names on the team sheet.
How did he fare when he began coaching?
Well, he takes over Barcelona at a low ebb. You know, they're usually at a low ebb. And he has this credibility from having been a coach, from having been a player there. And so he gets through two initial seasons that are not hugely successful. And meanwhile, he's assembling what came to be known as his dream team, composed
yes.
of local kids from the Masia, built around this skinny playmaker who couldn't tackle, called Pep Guardiola, who became his kind of footballing son. And he starts to buy in great foreigners, Romario, Michael Laudrup, Ronald Koeman. And he assembles this team that in 1992 becomes, they're not really the best team in the world. AC Milan are really the best team in the world in that era. But as it happens that year, Milan are banned from European football. And the dream team win the Champions League. And it's the first time in Barcelona's history, 1992, that they've won the Champions League. And suddenly they feel they're a big boy and Cruyff has made them.
And Ronald Koeman is the present day Barcelona manager, which will be a tough experience. He scored a winning goal in extra time, direct from a free kick. So there is a link, a very strong link between Koeman and Barcelona, and between the past and the present in that particular instance, because now Koeman, who is a respected figure in football internationally and until recently manager of the Netherlands, a very good young team now, he will have to manage decline, we imagine, Simon.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thankless job now. I mean, he got the job partly because he'd been anointed by Cruyff. They'd actually been next door neighbours in Barcelona. And so Cruyff is still the guiding spirit of the club, even in death. But Paul Koeman now faces the task of managing a club that has massive expectations, but has a wage budget similar to Everton's or Aston Villa's. So how are you going to be much better than Aston Villa if your wages are about the same? We know that in football, salaries determine league position fairly accurately. And so he's in the post-Messi era. All the remaining players of that great Spanish generation, Piqué, Sergio Busquets, Jordi Alba on the way out. So, yeah, I mean, this is, you know, the last time I went there when I was finishing the book in September 2020, I thought, I've been visiting Barcelona for 30 years and I've never seen them at such a low ebb. And that was before Messi left.
Now, you point out about the Masia. This is the youth academy. It wasn't just football that was inculcated. It was a way of behaving. And it's an interesting idea that they should behave, that there should be an esprit de corps, if you like. And it was very different from the way some of the great Barcelona players of that time, Ronaldinho springs immediately to mind, but there were others, and you draw attention to them in the book. Barcelona is a fun city, and some of the great players that Cruyff had to work with like to have fun and stay out all night.
Yeah, I mean, the Masia, you know, when I visited it, it struck me as a kind of Catholic seminary, you know, with all the terrible bits left out, or the way a Catholic seminary maybe should be, in that the coaches are very much concerned with raising children, with not just treating these kids as proto-professional footballers who you could discard ruthlessly if they didn't make it, but the club's taken on, and that's true of any club, has taken on this enormous responsibility. It's taking children away from their parents, making them live in this kind of boarding situation, and you then become in loco parentis in the club. Barcelona takes that very seriously, so the kids are given proper schooling. About half the kids from the Masia end up going to university. Guardiola did, Iniesta did. They didn't finish, but they did start university, and they're really quite well treated. And this struck me all the more forcefully when I visited the Masia a couple of times, because I'd seen an English Premier League academy. This is about 20 years ago, and I think it was fairly normal at the time. The coaches would scream at the kids, would behave sort of like sergeant majors in the army in the 1950s, would just brutalize them verbally, tell them they were rubbish, never praise. And the coach's argument was, well, that's what they did to me when I was an apprentice, and therefore it must be the right thing to do. So in a lot of academies, kids drop out, not because they're not good enough at football, but because they just hate it. It can be a really horrible, miserable environment with bullying by fellow players and by coaches, often no education delivered at all. So then you're kicked out of the academy at 15, 16, and your school has virtually been abandoned. And so the Masia is not like that. And I think it's not just the better way to do it. It's the smart way to do it, because you're not losing very talented kids just because the situation is so horrible.
The other factor in that equation, I believe, is that if you are bullied and if you are ordered around, you actually begin not to take responsibility. And the idea of being responsible for yourself and as a footballer is huge. And some of the characters who came out of that academy, I'm thinking of Lionel Messi, of course, but also of Xavi and Iniesta in particular. Taking responsibility is a very big part of being a great player.
I think that's extremely important, and it's a Cruyffian idea as well, that in football, you can't just obey orders. It doesn't really work, because you're not talking to the coach for 45 minutes at a time.
Yes.
You know, there are no timeouts. He's shouting something on the touchline, but nobody can hear him. And so the important decisions in a football match are made by the players constantly. Should I be 5 meters further back? Who's picking up the free man? Why have we lost the connection between midfield and attack? And these things have to be managed dynamically by players making their own decisions all the time. And that's what you learn at Barcelona. You don't learn to obey. You learn to make your own decisions on the field.
Yes.
And yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
The question of, I want to move to Pep Guardiola, who, as you say, has a very direct link to Cruyff. In the end, as a coach, Cruyff, as we call him here, forgive me, he began to lose interest. And you have an amazing story about his son-in-law, who was the reserve goalkeeper, and Cruyff played him. Left it, the very good Carlos Busquets, who is in fact, I think, the father of Busquets, who's in the present
exactly, yes.
Team. He swapped his son-in-law, who wasn't so hot. This is real contrarian and indulgent stuff. And there is a side to Cruyff, as you depict him, that is very, very difficult indeed, and not particularly likable.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, his son-in-law is the reserve goalkeeper, and his son, Jordi Cruyff, who we know as late having gone to Manchester United and so on, is also in the squad and is not the world's best footballer, so there's a lot of debate around that. I think one of the driving forces in Cruyff's life was that when he was 12, his father, the grocer, dropped dead, and yes, that was kind of the most formative, shocking event in his life. And so he enters what he regards as the football jungle as a 12, 13-year-old, without the protection of a father. And his mother cleans the changing rooms at Ajax to make money. And so when he becomes a father, he's determined that he will fight for his kids in every situation. And so he puts his son in the Barcelona squad so that he can keep an eye on him, look after him, etc., the son-in-law. And yeah, he also just loses interest in football a bit, in being a coach and doing the everyday work. And he becomes ever more radical. So Cruyff had always thought, well, the goalkeeper should just be a footballer. You know, you need 11 footballers on the field. We're not going to waste a man like all the other teams do by sticking him on the goal line in gloves. Our goalkeeper is going to be a kind of sweeper. And so he lights on Sergio Busquets' father, Carlos, who's an excellent footballer, very good with his feet. But the thing is, Carlos Busquets is not a great goalkeeper. He's not very good with his hands. So Cruyff persists with him, partly just to show everyone else up, to prove himself right. And Carlos Busquets makes the occasional clanger with his hands, including giving Manchester United victory in the Cup Winners' Cup final 91. But Cruyff sticks with him. So yeah, as he got older, he became more and more impossible. And I think what happens is, what happens to quite a lot of people as they get older, they lose a bit of interest in their job, in their career. And with him, it happened relatively early in his 40s. And so what is that? He never works again, really.
One of the pleasures of the book, and it's a deep and profound pleasure for me, who's read so many rather dubious football books, you give a real sense of the people who run Barcelona and also the people whose allegiance to the club is lifelong. I think you call them the socios?
The socios, the club members.
The socios, yes. It is, as we know, all of us, that it is a members-only club, and we therefore think better than the model elsewhere, particularly in Britain. But you have a real feel for these people, how small-minded they can be in some respects, but how significant they are, how important they are to the idea of Barcelona. Am I right in that?
Yeah, so it's a very local club. And as you say, there are these 150,000 members, the socios, most of whom, almost all of whom live in Catalonia, live in the region. And a lot of these people sort of inherit their club membership from grandparents, and you have it all your life, and you may not even particularly like football. You show up at matches 20 minutes after kickoff, but being a Barcelona member is part of your identity. It's part of who you are. It's also a very middle-class thing, unlike in English football. Being a Barcelona member is much more a bourgeois thing. And then the people who run the club are also very local types. I mean, this is not like Manchester City or Chelsea, where, or many English clubs, where they hire highly paid executives from elsewhere. Almost everyone I encountered inside Barcelona was from Barcelona. And so you have, I mean, in a way it's very nice because people expect to be there their whole lives. So they care about the youth academy because they think the kids in the youth academy, when they get into the first team, I'll still be here. So I care about that. And then there's a lot of petty jealousies and rivalries that you have with people you grew up with, whose parents you knew, who, you want to be president, and somebody who you've known since you were 6 years old is president and you don't respect him. So there's a lot of kind of bickering and infighting as well. But yeah, it's a very local place. And just very briefly, the place I realized this, I had one of these aha moments, was when I walked into the ice rink opposite the stadium. There's an ice rink with a little cafe, and you sit down in the cafe, and around you are all the Barcelona people who work there, the employees, and the next door room, there's the socios. There's a room where the socios play cards, and you realize this is really a small club. It's a family club.
Yes. Now, his coaching career, he was sacked in the end, Cruyff, but remained in Barcelona. Pep Guardiola is the most influential coach, I would argue, of the last 20 years. He was a player and clearly influenced by Cruyff's ideas, and seemed to share the essential Dutch idea originally of Ajax in passing, in really encouraging players to play, defenders to concern themselves with the creative side of the game. To the point in Guardiola's case, it's arguable, Simon, later on, that he actually had rather ordinary defenders, but a magnificent team. How did they get on? And is the sort of lineage of the club on the field direct from Cruyff to Guardiola, or did Guardiola in any way innovate and refine it?
Well, I'd say Guardiola is more than influenced by Cruyff. He's made by Cruyff. He's shaped by Cruyff. He's his spiritual heir. And Guardiola is picked out of the youth academy by Cruyff when he's 17, 18. And Cruyff takes this kid who can't run, can't tackle, and puts him in the first team. And Guardiola said that before he met Cruyff, he knew nothing about football. And so he just imbibes this. He's a very clever boy. He really cares about football. He wants, unlike a lot of people, he wants to listen to every word that Cruyff says. And so everything that Guardiola believes about football, the principles come from Cruyff. We have the ball in the other team's half. We pass at very high tempo. We interchange, and then we press when we lose it. And what Guardiola adds is, Guardiola is a more patient, disciplined, articulate, rigorous figure than Cruyff. So Guardiola sort of, Cruyff said, I don't care if they score three as long as we score five. But Guardiola wasn't like that. Guardiola wants to win 5-0. So he creates this these rules, like the 5-second rule. When we lose the ball, we press for 5 seconds and try to win it back. Or the 15 pass rule, which he had at Barcelona, doesn't really have any more now, which is when we get the ball, we pass 15 times so that we're all in the correct positions just in case we lose the ball. We're setting up our defensive organization. And Guardiola also had patience to watch the other team video for 2 days to identify the flaw in the other team that he would exploit. Yes. Cruyff didn't have the patience to do any of that. So in some ways, Guardiola is a better coach than Cruyff, but he's a completely Cruyffian coach. Cruyff is the original.
The arrival of Lionel Messi from Argentina, giving him the growth hormone he required, bringing his family to Barcelona, all of this is really perhaps the catalyst for greatness of the team that Pep coached.
Yeah, I mean, in playing terms, you have these two elements. You have Lionel Messi showing up for a trial age 13 and Charlie Ressa, who's head of the youth system at that point, saying, oh my gosh, who is this kid? We've got to give him a contract. And somebody says, but he looks like a table footballer. He's 13, yes. He's the size of a nine-year-old. And Ressa says, I don't care, bring me all the table footballers. And yes. So there's that. And then there's the greatest Spanish generation of all time, most of whom are coming through the Masia in the late 90s, early 2000s. Xavi, Iniesta, Piqué, Busquets, Leiza Pedro. And so you put together the world champions of 2010, the future world champions at that point, with the world's best footballer, and you have Guardiola's team. So in some ways, Guardiola is lucky to inherit that, of course, but he does add, he does give them a system and rigor that they might not have had under a different coach.
Yes, and we'll never forget that great spell, the Guardiola spell, which only lasted from 2008 to 2012. It's an unforgettable image. They were in that period the greatest team I think I've ever seen, undoubtedly. And I've seen some great teams at Manchester United and elsewhere. Also the Spanish team that won the European Championship 2008. The World Cup 2010, I think the European Championship again 2012. That great Spanish team was really full of Barcelona players and played the Barcelona way. That's a remarkable achievement in itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you see there is the fruit of the period when Cruyff is the pioneer, the innovator, and Barcelona is years ahead of the rest of football in how to produce players, in how to teach passing. The really very complex science of passing. If I pass to you, the third man must already be running to receive your pass, even before I've passed. Where should he be? Which diagonal should we seek, etc. It takes years and years to pass like that. And I think what happens later is everyone copies them. Everyone tries to do that, even countries like England or Italy, where this had never been the norm, and Barcelona and the Masia cease to be unique.
Now, it's very clear that, and I'm interested in your view of this, it emerges from the pleasure of reading the book, which is superb, is the influence that one thinker from the Netherlands, Johan Cruyff, has had on football and continues to have, and appears, if there ever was an ideological war about how football should be played, this is a total victory for the ideas of, in the first instance, Cruyff, and in the second instance, Guardiola.
I had always thought that Cruyff was the most interesting man in the history of football. He's kind of the Freud or the Moses or the Einstein of football. And it had always struck me that only the Dutch and the Catalans, maybe the Spanish, truly had a sense of who he was. So in England, you know, there wasn't much football on TV in his era. So people in England talk about the Cruyff turn, that moment in the World Cup 74 when he turns a Swedish defender, but they didn't have a sense of the whole Cruyff. Just this completely fascinating, maddening, impossible figure who I had a conflict with. He had a conflict with me like with everyone else. And I wanted to, for 20 years, I've been thinking about writing his biography. And instead, I cast it into this book about Barcelona because
Cruyff made it Barcelona. You did the right thing, Simon. It's a beautiful book and it works brilliantly. I actually sat beside him at a match. Manchester United were playing Wimbledon, the first game of the season. And I was with a group of wealthy Irish people, including the manager of U2, Paul McGuinness, who wanted to buy Wimbledon, which was for sale, and bring it to Dublin to create a Premier League club here. So I found myself sitting next to Johan Cruyff. And his son Jordi happened to be playing. It was the day that David Beckham scored that amazing goal from his own half. I'm sure you remember. It was the first game of the season. Anyway, in an effort to make some small contribution to the conversation, I said, I note your son Jordi is playing. It's brilliant to see him. And Cruyff said to me, he's not good enough for this level. He's a good boy, but he won't make it at this level. And he didn't say it in anything other than a matter-of-fact manner. And I thought, wow, that's pretty candid. But anyway, I mean,
I'm stunned, and that's something he never said in public, of course.
Yeah, he said it to me, and like that was the first thing he ever said to me. So, and the last thing as well, except goodbye. But I just want to move on, Simon, to the trouble that and what's happened with Messi and what's happened with the club in general in terms of salaries the players have, how much they were indulged. This club appears to be imploding at the moment. And the background to that is immediately understandable for anyone who reads your book, in that it is the small-mindedness of these bourgeois, even petty bourgeois types who run the club and become president. It is their small-mindedness that has made them incapable of keeping this club intact to the point now where they have lost Messi. They seem to be going nowhere. This is also part of the culture, isn't it? That small club that it used to be, rather like Ajax, also brings a small-mindedness.
I mean, you call it small-mindedness. I call it more localism. That these are guys who run the club who they were born in Barcelona. They're going to die in Barcelona. They spend their whole lives there. And what they care about is the opinion of people around them, their business partners, their children, the waiter who serves them coffee, the people they run into on the street they went to school with. And all these people are saying, you're going to keep Messi, aren't you? You're going to give him enough money for him to stay. You're going to buy a big name to succeed Neymar, aren't you? And every day, two newspapers that are fully dedicated to FC Barcelona, the radio stations to FC Barcelona until the early morning in Catalan. I mean, nobody else really follows it, but in that city, it matters immensely. And so these guys feel under immense pressure to keep the socios, the members happy every single day. And so I think that led to this, that kind of intense localism led to this, we'll give Messi however much money his dad asks for every year. So Messi's salary actually trebles between 2014 and 2020. And we'll pay whatever the selling club is asking for Dembele or Coutinho, because we have to have them, because otherwise the newspapers will be angry with me in the morning.
Yes, and you write also later on about the transactional nature of the relationship between a footballer and his club. And you talk about the badge, and you talk about, or write rather, about footballers as independent contractors. The game has taken a terrible turn in many ways, in terms of salaries and in terms of excess. It isn't the fault of Barcelona, but they don't have what Manchester City, PSG and other clubs do. They don't have petrodollars to spend. And this is something that has come to damage the club, particularly in their relationship with Lionel Messi, who clearly, in that press conference he gave a few weeks ago when he broke down in tears, was clearly genuinely in love with that club and clearly distraught that that relationship was no longer viable. It was a very moving moment, and you didn't have to be interested in football even to get it.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have petrodollars, but before the pandemic, they did have the highest revenues of any club in the history of sport. I mean, they were the first sports club ever to breach $1 billion in revenues in 2018. So they did have enough money. They wasted a lot of it. I mean, as for Messi, I think he's fond of the club, but I think he was crying partly because for the loss of his happy life and his family's happy life. I mean, he'd been there 20 years. It's the only life he'd really known as an adult. His children born and raised there. They didn't want to leave. They didn't want to go to a new country. They cried last year when he told them they were going to leave. The wife cried. So I think he was crying because it was a real shock to the family, as it would be to anyone if you're told, well, you're happy here and you've lived here for 20 years, but now you're going. And so I think that I wouldn't swear that Messi loves FC Barcelona. I would say he had an incredibly happy employer-employee relationship there for many years. And as a family, perhaps more importantly, it was the place where they felt rooted.
Yeah, just a couple of final questions, Simon. You do point to what I regard as one of Guardiola's more inspired changes. He moved Messi from being wide right, wideish right, to being a false number nine, if you like, to centre of midfield. It took him a couple of years to make that, but that change was, I think, very inspired and necessary, and that took Barcelona to another level. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, but I would say that it's as much Messi as Guardiola, that like any good coach, Guardiola is working with the grain. He sees this is what Messi likes to do. Messi likes to be in the centre. He wants to cut inside into the middle, and I'm going to encourage that and sort of formalise that. And the false nine, you know, has a long tradition in Croatian football. When you're playing against rooted centre-backs, you know, pair of big centre-backs like Real Madrid had then, or like English clubs typically have, what you don't want to do is give them someone to mark up front, because they're very good at that.
Yes.
You want to give them nobody to mark and exploit the space in front of them. And that's what Guardiola did. But then Guardiola made the mistake in a way of buying an old-fashioned number nine, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, the best number nine. And
Messi didn't get on.
Yeah, Messi says, I run into that space. And when I arrive there, I don't want some massive Swede shouting at me to give him the ball. So Guardiola had to get rid of Ibrahimovic almost immediately after buying him.
Okay, just a final question about Guardiola, who has now announced in the last 24 hours that he will leave Manchester City at the end of next season. And he left Barcelona after four very successful seasons. He left in 2012. Why do you think Guardiola left? And also, what do you think the future holds now for Barcelona FC, apart from wonderful, treasured memories?
I think Guardiola left because he understands more than anyone in football that football keeps evolving. The football of 2021 is better than the football of 2020.
Yes.
And it will be better again next year. And football keeps evolving. And so you, to stay at the top as a coach, you have to evolve and learn and think. And so you can't keep doing the same thing. And so after he quit Barcelona in 2012, he took a sabbatical in New York for a year, learned all sorts of things, football and outside. And he returned a more modern, updated version of himself. And he'll try and do that again. It's very hard to update yourself. Jose Mourinho hasn't really managed it.
No.
FC Barcelona as a club, the last decade, they've rested on their laurels. They haven't tried it. And I think that's what Barcelona needs to do now. They need to say, we're number two. We're no longer one of the world's best clubs. So what we're going to do is we're going to learn from the world's best. We're going to go and look at how Bayern Munich or Liverpool or Italy do things. We're going to steal their ideas like everybody stole our ideas a decade ago. That's the only way.
Just finally, as somebody not born in the Netherlands but growing up there, it is remarkable how the ideas first promoted with Ajax and indeed the ideas of Johan Cruyff have endured and enriched a sport, and how important an individual can be to this thing we all love so much.
Yeah, ideas really matter, and the people with ideas are very rare. There are other people who can copy them, but very few people have ideas that other people didn't, and Johan Cruyff did, and that's why sort of he and Messi are the main figures of my book.
Yes, well, I just would again say to you, it's a magnificent piece of work, and the author is Simon Cooper, we've just been talking to. The title is Barca, and even if you don't love football or live for football, it's a book worth reading. It's about a city and a time. It's a remarkable piece of work. If you love football and you ever watched that beautiful team, the dream team, then this book is essential reading. Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For joining us. Congratulations again. It's a magnificent piece of work. That's Simon Cooper, and the book is called Barca. That's all we have time for now. We'd like to thank all our listeners and all of you who contact us in one way or another. We treasure those contacts. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.